My life's an open book.
Your life's an open book.
Yeah.
Okay, but just like, you know, you should feel free to talk about whatever you feel comfortable talking about. But you understand from the release, from what we said, that your name will be used, and so fine. That's
I fine. Understand all that.
Okay, cool. So why don't you just like begin by telling me like when you found out that you were HIV positive and when you found, you know, found that you had full-blown AIDS and how that happened?
Well, I tested positive. The results were given to me at the C-76 facility at Rikers Island. I was arrested for a sale of narcotics, and as a result of the arrest and the plea bargain, I ended up doing a year in jail. I decided it was time to find out more or less if I was positive, because I had been using drugs for more than 30 years. So when I was told that I was positive, it was shocking. You can't begin to understand the feelings that went through me. My whole life came to a standstill right there and then. Luckily for me, I had someone who was very sensitive, the counselor, and she understood what I was going through, and it helped, I mean, considerably. I remember I wasn't able to move for about a good half hour. I was that shocked. I mean, on one hand,
I'm gonna have to move.
Yeah,
twice.
Sure.
So way,
on one hand, it shouldn't have come as quite a surprise, because, like I mentioned a few seconds ago, I've been involved in drugs for more than 30 years. Philadelphia, Texas, wherever I've gone, I've gotten involved in the drug culture. But it's kind of shocking when you actually, you know, confronted with the possibility of dying, you know, in a very short period of time. And that's what happened. I was just blown away. So I was still in C-76.
But what year was this?
2 years ago, and, 2 or 3 years ago, 1989.
So at the time, were you already showing symptoms or not?
No, I wasn't. No symptoms at all. No, and I've been lucky thus far to have very few symptoms. Very, very lucky, extremely lucky.
Did you, so do you know how you contracted AIDS and the HIV virus, essentially?
Yeah, well, yeah. It was through a sharing of hypodermic needles.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel comfortable talking a little bit about, or I'm assuming you're clean now? Or,
yeah, I am clean now.
So,
yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about?
Sure,
like,
why not?
In terms of your, you know,
yeah.
This is really important, I think, for, you know, especially for kids today to know.
Exactly.
The ups and the downs of what, like, you know.
Yeah.
So if you could just talk a little bit about how, you know, how you got involved with drugs.
Well, I was born and raised in South Brooklyn, all right. Like I mentioned, on Columbia Street, and during the 50s and the early 60s, drugs were although they were prevalent during that era, all right, they've been prevalent for a long time, it wasn't something that was done openly, you know what I mean? Not like today. You could actually drive up to certain spots in the city, all right, and seated in your car and cop almost anything, you know. But then it was a little low key, you know. People just didn't talk about it. Well, I came from a broken home. My mother and my dad separated at a very early age, all right, as far as I'm concerned. And
we completely edited, so just
So, like I mentioned, I got involved with drugs, I think at the age of 13. And heroin was the drug, you know, of the time. I mean, way back then in the 60s, heroin. And then LSD came into play, and the hardest stuff. But basically, off and on, I've been dealing with this drug habit and this problem for over 30 years.
You know. You said your parents separated. You grew up with your mom mostly?
I grew up with my granddad. And my two sisters and my brother grew up under my mom's roof.
So you grew up with the Italian side or the Puerto Rican side?
The Italian side. as a child, I didn't have very much in the way of support. My granddad was always at work. He was a longshoreman, all right? And my aunts married. I remember both of them living on the same roof and getting married, and that was the ending of my so-called childhood supervision. I mean, I came and I went as I pleased, and not having my dad's influence and my mom's influence in my life led me to be involved in a lot of things that kids shouldn't be involved in. And I started with smoke, a little grass, and then heroin and cocaine. Before you knew it, I was using a whole host of drugs. But like I mentioned, I've had this habit, I've been involved in drugs for almost 31 years. Hmm. Peer pressure played a large part in my decision-making process as far as me getting involved in drugs. I mean, everybody was doing it then, you know, and you didn't want to be one of the outsiders, you know. So you allowed people to talk you into almost anything.
When did you first hear about AIDS, and what did you think about it before you decided to get tested?
Well, the first time I heard about AIDS I remember back in 82, I think, 82, 83. I was married, and I had just recently gotten married, and my wife had a child, and my aunt, I was living in the South Jersey area. My aunt was very helpful to my wife as far as letting her know, you know, what she had to look forward to as far as married life was, you know, was concerned. And they were the ones that presented the AIDS question to me first. You know, we heard about it through the paper and then on the news, all right. It was just discovered back then, I think in the 83, 80, somewhere back then. But anyway, my ex-wife, she became so nervous with the probability of maybe contracting this disease through me that it created a lot of static between us.
You're saying ex now, but you were married.
I was married then, yes. Right, so and we fought for almost 6 years, 7 years, you know, over this issue, all right? You know, she encouraged me to get help so that this, you know, the possibility of me contracting this disease would never occur, and I wouldn't listen. I was just too involved with drugs. And
you were shooting up back then.
Yeah, I was shooting up. I had 30 years, off and on, off and on, off and on, you know. And my aunt encouraged my wife to present an ultimatum to me. Either you stop it, or I'm going to leave you. And this was in 88. And as a result of a heated discussion and an argument that we both had surrounding the issue, she left. She packed her stuff and she went to her mom's. You know.
Are she and your child? Are she and your child negative now? Do you know?
No, they're both negative. Yeah, they're both negative. I didn't contract the virus until I moved back to New York. While I was there, all right, although I was in a high-risk group, I hadn't contracted the disease yet.
That you're saying that because you weren't sharing needles back then, really?
I was, but not in the same type of enclaves. New York was considered like the place. If you were going to catch AIDS, I mean, you were going to catch it in New York, you were going to catch it in South Jersey or someplace else. It just wasn't that widespread yet. You know, now AIDS is all over. It touches every facet of our lives. It's everywhere. But back then it wasn't. And I came to New York. I broke up with her in 88 and came to New York. As a result of breaking up with her, I stood with my granddad for a while. I lived with him. And that's where I probably contracted the disease.
So when did you become aware of the idea that you weren't supposed to share needles or you should clean your works before you did them again? And like how long did you keep doing it before you, when you already knew?
I did it. Even past. I mean, what I'm trying to say is that although I knew that you could contract the disease that way, I continued to use drugs and I continued to share needles. You see, drug addicts heroin addicts don't carry needles in their pockets 24 hours a day. See, I was what was considered a functioning addict. In other words, I maintain my employment, all right? I maintain the family, despite the fact that I was involved with drugs. All right. Some people can't do that. I mean, they're just totally committed to this one thing, and that's it. Their lives evolve around the heroin thing. It wasn't that way with me. But I continued to share needles with people even after I knew that I could get sick.
So, what made you decide to get tested back? I guess around 90. Like 2 years ago, you said, when you were...
I thought it was a good idea. A lot of my friends were passing away, and I figured the best thing for me to do if I wanted to get a head start on this thing was to find out if I did have it, and if I did have it, to get some type of treatment as soon as possible.
So by that time, you had friends who had died, and you were really aware of what AIDS was like. What were your attitudes about? How are they different? Like then and now, 2 years after you've been...
Well, back then, the number of friends that I had that were involved with drugs, as far as people dying, all right, not very many had died, all right. This kindly hit home. This hit home when my friends started to die in twos and threes and fours and fives, you know. Like this year alone, I've been to 9 funerals, okay? And I just was recently at another funeral. Here's a card there. When did he die?
April 25th.
Yeah, and he had the virus. He had AIDS for almost 8-9 years, you know, before it developed into full-blown.
So it wasn't really until the last couple of years that it really hit home for you?
Yeah, when people started to pass away and I started to really think that, Jesus, you know, what am I doing to myself, you know?
Was that kind of like what sent you into like getting clean?
Well, no. What I actually did was a combination of a few things. I went to one of these funerals to see a friend of mine who had passed away because of the disease, and I met another friend there, and she arose she made me conscious of the fact that I looked fucked up. I mean, I was destroying my life, all right? And that it was time to stop. And that if I didn't stop, I would end up the same way my friend was. So it was a friend by the name of Julie Biscaino. She works for Con Edison. and she encouraged me to get some help to get cleaned up and hopefully to get involved with a methadone program or a therapeutic a community so I can get off this drug thing. Mm-hmm. And I did it. I did it. After 30 some odd years, I did it. Mm. You know?
Mm. Pretty neat. What have you done? You know, you said that you wanted to get tested, so if you were positive, you would take steps to do something about it. What have you done for yourself since you found out you were positive? Health-wise, whatever.
Well, health-wise, I've begun to receive treatment. All right, I'm currently on AZT and a whole host of other drugs I can't begin to mention. My T cell count has fallen all the way to 320. That isn't good. But if I hadn't stopped using drugs, I probably would have no T cells today, and I'd probably be dead or in the hospital, you know, fighting for my life.
What'd you do? Like, when you found out you're positive, you said, like, you know, you couldn't move, you couldn't speak.
Oh, man, I was like, I was just blown away. I just couldn't move a muscle in my body for a half an hour. She says, are you going to be fine? And I, the counselor, the AIDS counselor, and I says, yeah, just give me some time. This is sinking in, you know. I started having flashbacks of all the funerals I had gone to and all the things that I had done in my life and all the things that I wanted to do, all right, that possibly I would never get a chance to do because this thing would terminate me, you know. That's what probably hurts us the most is knowing that we could have done so much with our time. And, you know, we just didn't go about, you know, doing it the right way. And it's an empty feeling, you know.
So, like really specifically, how did you begin to take control of your health? You were still in prison.
Well, I was in prison, and I was released from prison early because I was one of the inmate representatives there, and guys used to come to me and surrender their weapons, okay? And the weapons, if you surrender the weapon, a shank, bullets, or anything to that effect, anything that was contraband in prison, you would get some type of credit on your time, all right? And I lost 20 days because of a fight, and then someone gave me a knife this big. All right, and when I gave it to the captain of security, he says, you know, you get your 20 days back if you want, and that puts you right out this door. So I left the same day. I left the prison, and I went to see my mom. I had hoped that my mom would support me, okay? And she knew about me being positive, but after 30 years of drug use and after some of the things that I've done in my lifetime, because of them, we haven't had a very good relationship, okay? Yeah, it's okay. We haven't had a very good relationship, so we ended up, for some stupid reason, arguing with each other, and then I left my mom's house, and I found myself homeless, and I started living with a friend. They were smoking crack there and shooting drugs, and as a result, I got involved all over again. All right, for being exposed to that. For 2 years, I was homeless. He lost the apartment. My friend lost the apartment. He went to jail, and I used to sleep in this anywhere I could, in the subways. But mostly down on Smith Street. In this shack, all broken down, abandoned building, you know, shack. So when I got on the methadone program.
So you weren't doing anything at this time for your health? You weren't seeing many doctors?
No. For 2 years, man, I just, you know, after I found out that I was positive, instead of taking control of my life and saying, well, this is what I'm going to do, I ran through a few series of setbacks, And I had just given up on myself and given up altogether, all right?
I know this is a tough thing to ask, but you were sharing needles at the time and you already knew you were positive?
Well, no, I had my own needles. Yeah, but I was sharing. Yeah, if, let's say, my needle broke or if I didn't have my needle with me. And yeah, I share. Mm-hmm. I share it. So that's where I probably contracted this disease. It was just, you know, as recent as 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. But I was homeless for 2 years, and then someone told me about this particular program. The AS was running. I was already receiving money from social services. Well, I was on welfare already. So I figured, well, let me give this thing a shot. If they can get me a room, then fine. Well, they did much more than that. They not only got me a room in the St. George Hotel, but they also provided me with the necessary treatment that was needed for me to get myself going in the right direction. I'm referring to Cumberland Hospital.
Right. People really want to, it's really important for people to understand the kind of specifics, like what you went to Cumberland. Just tell me like where you went, what you did.
Well, when I went to Cumberland, like I said,
what's the name of the place, the whole name?
Cumberland Medical Center. Right. It's actually I don't know what's the name of the specific program that I'm involved in. I do know, but I forget sometimes. But they're handling my treatment there, all right? And any social problems that I may have, all right, they refer to a fabulous young lady by the name of Quiñones, and she makes necessary referrals to other agencies if she can't help.
And they tested you, did your whole T-cell work?
Yeah, they work with me every week. I see them once a month, but if I have any problems, I can just walk in and if
and
I'm
they,
sick.
They got you the AZT and whatever else you need.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you think you've been getting like enough medical care, the medical care that you need from them? I mean,
well,
not everybody can get.
Yes and no. Yes, those people over there at Cumberland Hospital are fabulous, all right? They're fantastic. Dr. Rodriguez is very, very sensitive to our needs, all right? Our mental, physical, our secular needs, he's very, very sensitive, and you need that type of sensitivity, all right? Because we're confronted with so many problems. But as far as getting additional treatment and possibly in the area of experimental drugs, I'm going to have to look into that a little more because I don't know very much about what's available. But no, they take care of me very, very well there.
Do you think you're just like lucky that you managed to get into this good program? Because I know a lot of people who are PWAs who don't have a lot of money have trouble getting the services they need, the drugs they need.
Well, you see, you have to go to a specific agency that's sensitive to your needs. Like the Gay Men's Health Crisis Unit, they are good. They're number one in the fight against AIDS. All right, they're a very good agency.
You've got some help from them. So.
No, I'm in the process of getting an interview with them. They're very packed. They're packed, and you have to call them on Monday. They have a quota. They admit so many people into their program on a weekly basis. And I haven't been able to get, believe it or not, I've had that referral for about 2 months now, and every Monday I call there. You know, I just call a little too late, or there's no room. But I'll get involved with them soon, very, very soon. They'll more or less tell me what's available in the way of experimental drugs and what's happening. I try to stay abreast of as much as I can, regarding my physical condition and the new drugs and what's available to the general public. But a lot of people, and this is the bad thing about it, a lot of people who are in the position to help, all right, people who are afflicted with AIDS are not doing their best, all right. Like, for instance, in some of the hospitals, I don't want to mention any hospitals by name, but there are some hospitals in this particular area that are afraid to deal with people with our condition, all right. They shun us, All right. So on the circumstances like that, you're not going to get, you know, necessary treatment that that you need. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people are still very ignorant about this illness, and there's so much prejudice and so much stupidity, you know, that's involved.
Hmm. Yeah. Hmm. How so in terms of the housing situation at the St. George, DES, the name?
DAS.
DAS, yes. Sorry. So are you happy with what the kind of, what they?
No, exactly.
Just describe a little more, because it's a special program, right?
All right. Despite the fact that I've been a drug addict, I've been a drug user for over 30 years. By trade, I'm a paralegal. All right. I've driven buses for Trailways. I've had a lot of good jobs. All right. I have 2 years of college from Rutgers University, and I've had very, very good jobs. And what I'm living on now, as compared to what I was living on before, all right, this is killing me, you know, financially. Well, this is what I'm talking about. When you're used to making $30,000, $40,000 a year, and then, you know, you have to look at receiving assistance from Social Security and from DAS, and then having to live on a budget, you know, that consists of $197 every 2 weeks. That's not very much, you know. When you consider there's no cooking facilities in the St. George Hotel, I have to buy everything in a restaurant. You know, I have to have the meals prepared for me. It's rough. My check is gone as soon as I get it. You know, I'm not happy with that aspect of. Do you have an ashtray? Can I smoke?
I start cleaning the bathroom, so I'm like, hey.
Yeah.
He's just trying to drive me crazy. Clean the bathroom.
As far as living with the type of budget that I have, I'm not very happy about that, but there's not very much that one could do. I become extremely fatigued at times because of my physical situation, and I can't work. I'd love to go back to work and make some money and live the way, you know, a person should live, you know, but that's not possible right now, so I'm going to have to deal with this DAS thing and Social Security until I hit the lottery, I guess.
Right.
You know.
How is your how has this affected your family? I mean, your mom's still alive.
My mom's still alive. We don't have a very good relationship. Not very many people in my family know. My ex-wife doesn't know. My children don't know. My uncles and aunts don't know. There's only one or two people in my family who know about this.
Is that because you don't see them, or you just don't tell?
Well,
them?
I don't see them. I haven't had an opportunity to see them. They live in the South Jersey area, and I'm afraid if I did tell them, all right, forget it. They wouldn't understand at all. You know, they would not understand. My mother doesn't want me. It's a shame. I'm her son. She doesn't want me anywhere near her home. Mm-hmm. You know, because I'm positive. Mm-hmm. And that's rough.
Because she was just really, really...
Yeah, you know, she's tough. She's a tough woman. She doesn't want me. You fucked up your life. This is you. You deal with it. You know.
Do you think that'll change when if you become sicker, that your family?
No, I doubt if it'll change her mind at all. She's very callous.
But what about your like sisters and brothers and your children? I mean,
you know, a person who's afflicted with this disease doesn't want pity. He doesn't want sympathy. Yes, sympathize with me, all right, but don't show me this sympathy that's going to demean me and make me feel like I'm not a person, all right, or make me feel uncomfortable. I think that'll happen, you know, if anything. If I told my family on the other side of the river that I was, you know, I was positive, I think that would happen. They would start to pity me and, you know, and things like that. I don't want that, you know.
Do you have friends, though, who you're still friends, if you were friends with for a while, who would know that you're positive? And
yeah, I have a lot of friends who are very happy not that I'm positive, but very happy that I've gotten off the drugs, mm-hmm. and that I've sought help and treatment. Because no one, you know, deep down inside, you don't desire anything bad for anybody else, not unless you're a maniac. Mm-hmm. You know, you'd like to see people doing well, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And they want to see me do well, you know, and ever since I've been off the drugs and on methadone and getting treatment, I've gained somewhere in the area of 50-some-odd pounds. Hmm. So you can just imagine how skinny I was before. And I look good, you know, I feel good, and it makes them feel good when they look at me and they see that I'm not involved in this drug thing anymore, and that I've taken steps to, you know, to alter my lifestyle.
So your body's improved, mostly.
Yes, it has. Hmm. Yes, it has.
Well, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
What about, you may not want to talk about this, but your sexual life and your sexual practices, have things been different? I mean, there's a whole lot of change in your life in general.
Well, shit, yeah, don't you know it? Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I was very, very active prior to me being positive, all right, very active. I'm not exactly a bad-looking guy. Very, very active sexually, and now it's not that way. I haven't had sex in almost a year and a half, all right.
Is that because you don't want to, because you don't...
Well, no, because of my situation. Mm-hmm. I mean... if I go in and look, if I go and buy a piece of ass, it's a different story. You know what I mean? But if I'm going to get intimately involved with someone, that person has to know. All right. And how do you go about telling, you know, someone who you're about to get involved with, all right, on an intimate basis, that you're HIV positive, and that it would be a good idea if we use a condom, and you know, stuff like that, of that nature. I mean, you just get blown away. I've been looking for an apartment. I've been encouraged to look for an apartment through DAS, and mind you, realty agencies, all right, the realtors, once they find out that you're HIV positive, they literally close the door on you. You know, they don't want to have nothing to do with you. So you just imagine having to deal on a one-on-one basis with a person that you want to become intimately involved with. I mean, it's just how you do it, mm-hmm. you know? So that's what's, yeah, it's my lifestyle has changed considerably in that, as far as that aspect is concerned. Mm. You know, I'm not as active as I used to be.
Right. How much time each week do you spend, you think, dealing with being positive and going to the doctor? Or
24 hours a day, 24/7. All right? There isn't a moment that goes by during the course of the day that you don't think about this. All right? I found myself two or three times already getting drunk. All right? I mean, getting blitzed to try and forget, all right, just for a few minutes that, you know, I'm positive and that there's a strong possibility that I won't be here, you know, within the next few years, and that I won't be able to do many of the things that I've always wanted to do in my life. But then there's nothing I can do about it. But no, this is 24 hours. There isn't a moment that goes by that I don't think about this. And sometimes I think about it so much that I get this urge to use drugs, you know, to try to help me to forget. You know, thank God I've had the strength to stay away. You know, I've dealt with it. I've tried my very best to deal with this thing.
Have you thought about getting involved? I don't know, as a volunteer or something like
that? Yeah, I'm in the process of offering my services, my paralegal services, to a Legal Aid Society and the Brooklyn, what do you call that organization?
Brooklyn,
oh my
Force?
God. No. It's Brooklyn Legal Services. Mm-hmm. All right. So they're going to let me know this week if they can use me. And I am going to get involved. I'm going to do some volunteer work for. I'd like to be able to get into schools and talk about this AIDS thing, you know, with some of the younger kids, and encourage them to stay away from drugs, you know, encourage them to find different alternatives to dealing with their problems. Because basically people use drugs because they're laden with problems that they don't know how to deal with, you know what I mean? At least that's what did it for me, you know. I'd like to be able to talk to kids, you know.
You were talking a little bit about how you've had a lot of friends die in the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
I know you grew up in Red Hook over here, and I was talking to somebody else, his husband had died, who was Italian, who grew up in Red Hook.
Yeah.
She was saying, like, so many of his friends who grew up in that area have died, how it's devastated that community.
It's just destroyed us, man.
I mean, did you go back over here in the neighborhood?
Well, they're in. Yeah, there. I always. My uncle still lives on Columbia Street, and the apartment that I was raised in practically all my life. They're renovating it now. I was thinking, wouldn't it be nice for me to end it all here? You know what I mean? It's very nice neighborhood. I mean, it overlooks the Manhattan skyline. You know, Columbia Street, that portion of the block does anyway. And I still go down there a lot. I was once told that, man, you can take Adolph away from Columbia Street, but you can't take Columbia Street out of Adolph. I mean, it's just, that's what most of my, I've been married twice, and both my ex-wives told me that, Jesus Christ, man, you don't want to leave the neighborhood alone. What is it? These are my people. This is, you know, I grew up here, and they're part of me, and how do you tell part of yourself, you know, not to exist? You know, it's just impossible.
So have you seen a lot of the people you grew up with?
Yes, and most of the guys that I grew up with that are still alive now, they know that I'm positive, and I'm always trying to encourage them to get off the drugs, you know, and get involved in some type of program. Because I know that the majority of them are positive, all right? But they want to live as if this thing didn't exist. They're living in denial, you know. When it happens, it happens. If it happens, fine, then I'm going, you know. Otherwise, I'm not even going to bother to take the test, you know what I mean? Mm. It's like that. I was just too worried about getting involved sexually with someone, you know what I mean, and things like that, of that nature, or sharing a needle with someone that, you know, I don't ever want this on my conscience. I gave AIDS to someone else. I passed meek. I don't know. I couldn't live with myself. I could not live with myself. You know. Hmm.
Did you, the people you live with at the St. George, like the people who are in that program, yeah. what are the people like there?
Well,
Who are the other people who are in?
Basically, they're all positive, and they're physically, they, I mean, this virus has, for some of them, gone to full-blown AIDS, all right? Some of them are really sick, and some of them are not. They're regular people, all right, just like you and I, all right? They have a thirst for life. They want to live. They want to enjoy life. It's just unfortunate that because of a few mistakes they've made in their lives, they have to be subjected to having to die because of it.
What do you think, what would you like to see different now? Mm-hmm. Elaborate. What would you like to see different about that program, especially, you know, for the people there?
What
would you
Well, think? What I'd like to see different, I'd like to see more people involved as far as our churches today, all right? The subject is anathema. I mean, when if you discuss it in church, all right? I don't think there's enough support groups, all right, to help people in our situation. All right, I don't think there's enough. I don't think that the churches throughout the United States have done enough, all right, to support those people who they're trying to reach in the first place. All right, we have a president that has continually put this subject on a back burner. You know what I mean? This should be a part of a platform, part of their platform. And Clinton and Perot and Republicans, they don't want to discuss it. You know, we need a president who's going to declare war on AIDS, all right? And we need someone who isn't going to drag his feet, you know, because people are dying every day, every moment of the day behind this. And, you know, how do you justify a person dying because of a lack of research or a lack of money? And then on the other hand, we're sending millions of dollars, all right, or spending millions of dollars overseas, you know, as part of our foreign policy, as part of our space program, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. No, a lot more can be done, all right? We're talking about life and death here. And not enough is being done by those people who, you know, have the power to do something.
Mm-hmm. If there was like one message you wanted to give to people in Brooklyn,
yes.
If you were speaking to a group of teenagers at a high school, mm-hmm. what would you tell them about AIDS?
What would I like to say?
Yeah, like this is your chance. Imagine people are going to listen to this.
Well. What I would like to tell them, or the message I'd like to get across is AIDS does not discriminate. AIDS does not care if you're black, white, Puerto Rican, if you're a school teacher. AIDS does not discriminate, all right? If you leave yourself open to this through sexual promiscuity drug use, intravenous drug use, and you don't take precautions, you are going to contract this disease and you are going to die. What I want to tell them is just to make certain, take certain precautions, all right? I mean, if you gotta get involved with drugs, all right, use your own needle and don't share it, all right? If you have to be involved sexually, then use a condom. You know, this is a terrible price to pay for a mistake. You know what I mean? Death? Come on. You know? No. That's what I'd like to tell them. You know? And to stay away from drugs. Young kids have to learn, man. You know. We don't have any role models today. All right? Years ago, we had so many role models. You know what I mean? We looked up to so many people. Today, kids are looking up to that guy that's driving the BMW. That's making all that money selling the drugs. All right? So this is so far we've gotten. You know?
Is there anything else you'd like to air or talk about or topics we didn't touch on that I'm sort of done with all my questions?
Oh, there's probably a thousand and one things that,
ahead.
You know, I'd like to talk about, but sometimes under a situation like this, just your thoughts don't flow.
That's okay.
You know what I mean?
Don't worry about that. Is there
so I'll just have to touch base with you again. Come back and we'll talk again. That's all.
That you were like hoping especially to talk about as part of the interview. Because this interview is going to, like, people will actually be able to hear this, not parts of it.
Yeah.
They'll pick up a telephone and they'll hear different voices of different people we interviewed, like at the museum, on the wall kind of thing. So mm-hmm. Here's your chance to talk to the general public and my quotes from you and some words.
Well, what I'd like to say, all right, is what I already said before, take precautions, all right, sexually, hopefully, I don't want to see anybody involved with drugs, but if you have to, if you're compelled, take the time to wash your works out, your needle, whatever you're using.
No, the bleach, man.
Yeah. And don't share works, don't share needles. All right. For those people who if they come across someone who is afflicted with this disease, that they would be sensitive to them, that they would realize that there's only one way you can catch it, all right, and it has to be sharing body fluids, all right, of some sort. And you can't catch it by sitting on a toilet or by kissing someone or by drinking behind someone or having someone touch you, okay? Be sensitive. Because these people are really, they're really going through a terrible time.
Oh, okay.
They're really going through a terrible time. Terrible time. All right. Financially, emotionally, mentally, they are going through a heck of a time. You know? Hmm. Be sensitive towards them. That's what you don't get very much of today, you know? You mentioned the fact that you're. I'm one. I don't hide things. If I have to, I'm not ashamed of the fact that I had some problems. I got involved with drugs. I made a mistake. I got exposed to the AIDS thing. I'm not ashamed of that.
Have you had specific examples like where you've received like nasty remarks?
Oh, every day. It happens every day. I've had. I go through this every day.
Can you tell me like a specific story you remember or stories?
I'm trying to find a good one. All right. I told someone, he's also an intravenous drug user, all right, about me being positive. The guy, although he is, he's involved in drugs too, He just couldn't grasp, all right, the thought of him talking to someone, all right, or being involved with someone to any extent that was exposed to this. And I couldn't understand it because, oh, come on, you know what the score is. You're out there. You've been out there. You know what I mean? Why should you get all hot and bothered about this? you know? You're in a high-risk group, buddy. But no, this guy got all...
He didn't even want to talk to you.
Oh, no, forget it. Forget it. I thought he was a friend. Apparently he wasn't.
You know? That's happened a lot.
Oh, it happens a lot, yeah. You see the expression on people's faces when you talk to them and you mention that you're HIV positive. It's not something that you should just come up right out and say, but if you're involved in an intimate conversation with someone, I don't make no bones about it. And man, you'd be surprised how many people are, you know, surprised. Oh my God, AIDS, oh no. You know, and they just walk away from you, or they find something else, another excuse to hit the road.
Well, actually,
yeah, you have to leave it
one. Yet, but I kind of do all my questions. If you're done with everything, we consider.
No, there's probably about 1,000 questions you want to ask me, but because of the time factor. I grew up, like I said, in South Brooklyn. All right, it's the oldest Puerto Rican community in the country, and I take great pride in that. All right, in knowing that my grandfather was one of the immigrants that came here on that ship called Marine Tiger.
Your mom's dad.
My granddad, right. My father's father.
Uh-huh.
He was one of the first to come here from Puerto Rico on this ship called Marine Tiger.
Oh, your father's Puerto Rican, your mother was Italian?
My mother's Italian.
Oh, okay, yeah. I'm confused. Yeah, all right, yeah. Okay.
My mother's the Guinea. I had always had aspirations as a child of becoming a major league ball player, all right? I grew up during the Yankee dynasty years, all right? And my idol was Mickey Mantle, you know? One of the best switch hitters that ever lived. Even my batting stance, I structured it after him. You know what I mean? I love sports. I love the theater. Okay, a nice good movie. I love white wine. I like to get out. I like to socialize. All right, I like to do things different. You know. I do different things, you know, things that I haven't been exposed to before. And this is one thing about this ailment, this disease that troubles me. Gee, we never know. You never know when you're going to find yourself laying in bed fighting for your life. All right? And, you know, I think about all the things I haven't done, all the things I'd like to do, you know? There should be some type of foundation that, you ever heard about the foundation that helps these kids out when they have the terminally ill cancer,
mm-hmm.
and they give them their last wish, like if they want to go to Disney, they should have something like that for us, you know what I mean?
Well,
all right.
What would your special wish or special dream right now be?
Probably it would be, to go inside the Yankee dugout. That's it. Just to go inside the Yankee dugout and be part of a ball game. You know what I mean? Get the feeling of I'd like to do that. That you know, of all the things you could ask for, money, you know what I mean? As far as your last wish, you know, what would you like to? That's what I would like to do. I'd just like to, one game in the Yankee dugout. You know, just be part of the guys. I'd like that.
Never know, sometimes dreams come true.
Yeah.
That's pretty neat. You should, if you get a chance, you should kind of go take a look at the museum downstairs. I think it's not the Yankees, they have
Dodgers.
The reconstruction of the Dodgers.
Dodgers.
You worked inside there?
No, my dad's a Dodger fan,
yeah,
man.
We have Dodger stuff down
most
there.
Of Brooklyn people, we're Dodger fans. If they wouldn't have left, we'd still be rooting for them, man.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. Okay, I do know this stuff.